Testing, testing. Oh, so it's working. Okay, I'm going to try to get into my therapy voice mode. Good morning to anyone who's listening. This is also a specific podcast on Anchor, picking up from last August. It is now January 25th, 2021, and I'm going to use this again, this medium platform for discussing something with students in the winter course that we are currently in Intro to Philosophy at Roger Williams. I'm going to be referencing Andrew Kania's Philosophy of Western Music, a Contemporary Introduction, just recently published, and comparing it to Ted Gaia's Music, a Subversive History, also just recently published. I think those two texts should be compared to each other and used for an introduction, general introduction to philosophy of music and in music history. Gaia, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, his work is a game changer, most definitely. But in the Kania, I'll just read the table of contents, and then I'm going to specifically reference chapter 5 because that's the chapter the class is looking at right now. And reference the second half of chapter 5 because that is the lecture we are on at the moment. But the table of contents is important, and I've always read indexes and table of contents as indicators of the general pattern of the text and the insights that it might offer. There's sort of a logic to indexes, table of contents, footnotes. There's entire works written on the history of footnotes and doing things that way, but here are the table of contents: song and the medium of music, emotions in the music, this is Kania again, emotions in the listener, musical understanding, the value of music, which is the chapter that this podcast will reference for the next 45 minutes to an hour, performance, authenticity, improvisation, recordings, music and morality, and the definition of music. It's interesting that he ends with that one because I feel like the last chapter would go with the first chapter and should be read together. But now there, I say this with respect. There are a lot of logic problems with this work, in Kania's new work, but there's also a lot of amazingness and a lot of philosophy. I think Gaia's text is a good, respectful challenge to the logic problems in Kania. But let's just focus for the moment on chapter 5, The Value of Music. Now, the first half of the chapter we've already talked about in class, the difference between intrinsic, instrumental, and inherent value. For those who don't understand the, you know, what we do in philosophy, those are three very important concepts that we often compare, especially in topics that have to do with ethics and morality. But in general, in aesthetics, also, those are three very important concepts in the philosophy of aesthetics. And so we've already done that, the monism versus pluralism, subjective, objective, and intersubjective value, and the difference between subjective, objective, and intersubjective value. At the moment, for the next few minutes, we're going to talk about the value of musical emotions. I'll probably put sound in the background as usual, other than my voice, other sounds, musical sounds, and act as your modern-day troubadour at the moment, if I may, the little I know about the history of that. But the value of emotions in music, the value of emotions in the listener, the puzzle of negative emotional responses to music, resistance to the affective value of music, the value of formal and basic musical features, which we'll probably not do too much with here, but those sections include the value of musical content and form, and the value of musical abstractness, which we're going into for the rest of the class, so I don't know how much I'll say here, but for right now, the value of musical emotions, second half of chapter 5. I'm going to direct this to the students that are in the class. So if anyone else is listening and you're not familiar with this text or chapter, just bear with us. In 5.2.1 section, page 139, Kania says this under the value of emotions in the music. that it is worth noting that if the value of music's expressiveness resides solely in the arousal it enables, then its value is more instrumental than if that expressiveness were inherently valuable. Now, without going into too much definitions about this, because the students have already heard about and talked about, and we've all discussed this difference between instrumental and inherent value, it's interesting that Kania makes that emphasis, that there is more to, you know, instrumental value than we might think at times, especially when it comes to the value of music's expressiveness. And so he's referencing another music philosopher scholar, Peter Kivy, and he says, Peter Kivy argues that any perceptible property that admits of qualitative degrees, for example, that can be possessed to a greater or lesser degree, possessed is an interesting word, isn't it? Is an artistically valuable feature of a work if it is, one, possessed to a greater degree, and two, not necessarily a defect. It follows, Kania writes, that some works will be valuable in part for their intense expressiveness, end quote. Right? So, Kania goes on to say, let's talk about, for example, the idea of despondency and brutality and the many forms that those might take. Hard thing to think about, especially when it's happening to you, but he writes, it is questionable whether the latter is in fact an emotionally expressive property. Why? Because we may be able to defend despondency and the like by arguing logically that even if actual despondency must be a defect in a work, the mere appearance of or expressive despondency is not necessarily a defect in any artwork, right? And he's talking about Kivy's notions here. So Peter Kivy, right? Kivy also argues that, quote, some expressive properties serve to highlight musical structure, as color might be used by a painter to emphasize contour or mass. Other expressive properties serve as structural properties in their own right, end quote. And he says, Kania says, an example of the first kind of case might be an emotional climax that coincides with the recapitulation of a sonata form movement. An example of the second might be the constitution of a piece's ABA structure by its sad, happy, sad, expressive profile, end quote, right? Well, this is Kania. In both cases, however, note that the value of the expressiveness seems to be purely instrumental, that is, as a means to the appreciation of musical form. So let's just stop here for a moment. If you're going to say that the value is instrumental of anything, even this class, and that it is instrumentally valuable, which we know there are problems with instrumental value, right? If you're going to say, though, that it has instrumental value in this way as a means to the appreciation of musical form, or as a means to the appreciation of philosophical form, or as a means to the appreciation of artistic form, you're still talking about form. And using form for some greater end, some maybe teleological end. And there's a lot of logic problems with doing things in that way. So on page 40, Kania then is referencing another philosopher, Levinson, which we've already talked about briefly, but without you even having to know Levinson's work, because we're just focusing on Kania's text. This is the quote that is really interesting here on page 140. Levinson puts it, the value of musical expressiveness is, in part, quote, the value of confronting images of human experience, but woven out of the substance of music, which enables a peculiar intimate experience of the emotions expressed. This may not seem very informative, but perhaps defenses of intrinsic value, right? Claim necessarily face this problem. How? In John Stuart Mill's formulation, quote, questions of ultimate ends, like teleological ends, are not amenable to direct proof. Whatever can be proved to be good must be so by being shown to be a means to something admitted to be good without proof, end quote. And there's going to be a lot of problems with that. But it's particularly important that you pay attention to what all of the logic there might be, or try to, and just try to start to. This is only an intro level course, so just try to start to. Malcolm Budd, however, simply denies that the mere experience of expressiveness is valuable, right? So let me read this Malcolm Budd quote, and then I'll show you how that's happening right here, even in this podcast. Budd writes, "The basic and minimal sense of the musical expression of emotion does not in itself constitute an aesthetic value. It does not automatically endow music that accords with it an aesthetic value. The aesthetically sensitive listener can perceive an emotion in music and yet be aesthetically unaffected by the perception," end quote. So here's the question, just a little pause here, bracket. Here's the question then. If that's true, and we're on page 40, but this is just me. If that's true, that the aesthetically sensitive listener can perceive an emotion in music, right? Meaning an emotion that the performer was trying to convey. So we've got the problem of solipsism here, but and many other problems, existential and otherwise. But if it's true that the aesthetically sensitive listener can perceive an emotion in music that you're listening to, that was recorded by someone else, performed by someone else, et cetera, and yet that they can also be aesthetically unaffected, with an A, by the perception, we've got a lot of questions here. Like, there are a lot of things to talk about. Is it possible, for example, to understand an emotion by a performer, understand an emotion being performed, understand an emotion being recorded by a musician, for example, and yet be aesthetically unaffected by that perception? If that's true, then we've got a mind-body problem again. We've got a phenomenological question. If you can understand something like an emotion in another human being, or even twice removed in a recorded performance musically by other human beings. And what if there are no human beings? What if it's instrumental? Is there emotion in instrumental music? How do you prove it? Right? This is what the rest of these chapters in this text are also about in Cania. But if that's true, then can you actually be aesthetically unaffected? When you're understanding aesthetic emotions, can you be aesthetically unaffected? This is the logic problem. And this may continue with some pauses, and I'll try to edit those, but let's just keep going. More widely touted, this is bottom of page 140. More widely touted than any discussed so far is the argument that music's expressiveness is instrumentally valuable providing us with knowledge of the emotions. So that's what we're talking about here, right? In other words, can expression be merely a cognitive process? So we've got the distinction here now between cognition and affect, which is all over Spinoza. And as you all know in the class, I am a Spinoza person, and, you know, philosophically, I have studied Spinoza. I'm not a Spinozist, but I do love Spinoza. So do you have a difference here between expression as a cognitive process that can be understood, of which then you are completely and wholly unaffected? I don't think so, but there is a good logic problem here. On page 141, Kania goes on, after discussing a little bit about the philosopher Davies, though he does not always clearly distinguish the cognitive value of expressiveness from that of arousal, James Young, another philosopher of aesthetics, seems to make an even greater claim for the value of expressiveness. What are we talking about here? The value of expressiveness. Arguing that expressive music can give us insight into the nature of the various emotions it expresses, patterns of emotional experience, and thus of human character. So if you can understand patterns of emotional experience, and thus equals of human character, if those two things do in fact go together, which I'm not so sure they always do so easily, then we can talk about the value of expressiveness, perhaps in an instrumental way. Okay, so a final worry regarding cognitivism, which would be what we're kind of talking about here, right? Bottom of page 141, cognition. A final worry regarding cognitivism about musical expressiveness is that other things, such as philosophical and psychological books about emotion, psychoanalytic too, might seem to be much better sources of knowledge about them. Perhaps, perhaps not. If so, this may show the cognitive value of musical expressiveness to be rather slight, in the same way that the value of butterfly nets for catching mice is shown to be slight by comparison with the effectiveness of mouse traps. Interesting. So now, moving on to the value of emotions by the listener. This is a really fascinating section. This is about imagination theorists. This is also about abstraction and empathetic versus sympathetic responses. This is about the puzzle, as Kania puts it, of negative emotional responses to music. This is also about resistance to the affective value of music and realists. And one of my favorites, the scholar Bereskaut, sorry if I mispronounce that, G-A-U-T and B-E-R-Y-S is the first name. And the value of formal and basic musical features, which we're going to kind of end there today with this lecture or session or troubadourishness. I'm not sure what we can call it. Interesting. But here, if you go back to page 137 and recall and remind ourselves, even though I think there are two recordings here happening on my Anchor podcast, so I apologize. My phone was hacked, right? But as if human beings are only technology, we are not. But if we go back to 137, this example illustrates one further helpful distinction for thinking about musical value. Do you remember that between preference and evaluation? Even when we understand two artworks equally, or two art theories equally, or two persons of aesthetic theories equally well, we may prefer to experience the one that we judge to be inferior, or we may prefer to experience one that we judge to be superior, or, you know, this is a personal preference issue, not an evaluative issue. Remember from page 137, you may be well aware that the worst Radiohead song is better than Justin Bieber's greatest hit. But sometimes you just can't take another depressing Radiohead song. All this shows is that preference is not the same thing as evaluative judgment. This is important to remember in disputes about which artworks or artists are better than which others. And in disputes about value, we tend to focus on the hard cases. Who's the greater singer, Adele or Beyonce? And you remember that we talked about this in class. This is a really stupid question, actually, right? You can't really ask that kind of question. Pursuing such questions, we may come to think that there's no fact of the matter here, Kania writes, that we are ultimately stating our subjective preferences rather than defending objective evaluations. But even if this is correct, it doesn't show that there aren't easy cases. Few ask, who's the better singer, Beyonce or me, for example? The answer in most cases is obvious, and obviously not subjective, right? Beyonce is clearly a better singer than you or I here listening. And so, you know, it's not subjective. It's not a personal preference. There's an answer. It's objective. Beyonce is better. And we talked about this in class already. But moreover, Kanye writes, our difficulty in answering the hard question here could be due to our ignorance or our other shortcomings or to the fact that neither Adele or Beyonce is objectively speaking the better singer. Perhaps they are equally good, or perhaps there is no fact of the matter about which is better. But why do we think that putting ignorance and preference aside, other people ought, at least sometimes, to evaluate the same music in the same way we do? Right? So Kanye ends that page, but our willingness to engage in rational debate over artistic evaluation, to consider the opinion of experienced critics, and it's not opinion, right? If you're an experienced critic, then there's more going on than just opinion. But if we're going to consider these experienced critics and their theories, and to learn more about music that many people seem to find rewarding, or any aesthetic experience that so many people seem to find rewarding, suggests that we think that we share capacities that will ultimately or ideally lead to agreement with respect to at least large swaths of musical evaluation, even if there is some remainder that can only be explained as individual preference. Interesting, right? Even if there is some remainder that can only be explained by each person's individual preference. And there it goes. Now I know how that... the difference here on page 142 between sympathetic and empathetic responses, this just in general, and then resemblance versus imagination theorists. We'll just leave it there today, but we'll talk about this for a little while, right? What is the difference between resemblance theorists, cognitivism theorists, and imagination theorists? And we're going to discuss that here. So you have to understand the difference between sympathetic and empathetic responses. And if, you know, as some philosophers believe, empathy cannot be taught, then I don't understand, this is just my side note, I don't understand how you can then understand the difference between sympathetic and empathetic responses, logically speaking, if you know what I mean. But in general, I do believe empathy can be taught, and sympathy for that matter. But if the difference is that when you share sympathetic responses with others, then can you share them? Because the idea of sympathetic responses, which the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche said sympathy is one of the worst basest emotions human beings can have. The reason is because a sympathetic response is sort of like, I understand, I hear you, but I don't understand because I cannot empathize. Meaning, I hear or see what you're saying, but I really haven't had that experience, don't agree, don't have that preference. Whatever it may be, I can sympathize, but I can't empathize. Empathetic responses are where you understand the experience the other person is going through. If you really understood what the other person was going through, then that means you have in some way experienced that yourself. That is an empathetic response. But if you have not had that experience, then it's a sympathetic response. So that's just a quick, easy way to understand that. So the imagination theorists say, right, in philosophy of music and philosophy of aesthetics, that our emotional experience of music is more intimate, more like interacting with an actual person who is expressing her emotions. And they tend to place, this is Kanye, top of page 142, they tend to place greater value on our emotional responses, while those such as resemblance theorists, the word here being resemblance, right, resembling, for whom our emotional experience of music is less like such interpersonal interactions, tend to place less value on such responses. So an easy way to recall or understand or remember or try to think about the difference, notice you're using both imagination and rational cognition at the same time there, is that imagination theorists tend to say you're imagining what it's like to have that experience. So in a way, it's both sympathy and empathy, but you're imagining that you're interacting with the actual person who is expressing their emotions, let's say in the music, or expressing her, his or her emotions in the aesthetics. And then you tend to place greater value. Instrumental, I don't know. Intrinsic? Maybe. Inherent? Definitely. But you tend to place greater value in your emotional response and the emotional response of the performer or the music or the emotions in the music. Now, those are three very different categories, logically, but it seems to be happening here. Well, resemblance theorists say, you know, that that's not an interpersonal interaction you're having with the music or the performer or the aesthetics, the art piece. And therefore, it's something different. When we're talking about the cognition, the philosophy, it's a different logical category. And Kania writes here, we can see all of those points illustrated in the question of instrumental cognitive value of our emotional responses to expressive music. Some might even say sound. The cognitive value of such responses is more secure than that of the experience of expressiveness, because the question of accuracy does not arise so forcefully. If we are learning about an emotional experience by having it, Kania writes, as opposed to perceiving its expression in the music, then it seems much more likely that the beliefs about it that we acquire are accurate. Let me say that again. Repetition. If we are learning about an emotional experience by actually having it, as opposed to just perceiving its expression in the music, then it seems much more likely that the beliefs about it that we acquire, say, are accurate. But now recall from other chapters that we didn't study in this class, but I can help you with, some of the differences between resemblance and imagination theorists' accounts of our emotional responses to expressiveness itself. The resemblance theorist believes that we are, quote, infected with the mood associated with the emotion expressed by the music, and I would tend to agree. While the imagination theorist thinks either that we imagine of such a response to the music that it is one of fully fledged emotion, or that we simply respond with a fully fledged emotion that is similar, like a realist might say. Since the imagination theorist can allow for contagion responses, right? The music is contagious. The sound is contagious. In addition to any further emotional responses to which our musical imaginings give rise, her theory likely allows for a wider range of emotional responses in at least three respects, right? So then the discussion becomes, what are those? First, sympathy versus empathy. Second, our affective responses are restricted to moods. Huh. And then the distinction between what the resemblance and imagination theorists might debate there. What is the mood of the piece? Third, the fact that the range of emotions expressed by music is wider, according to the imagination theorist, right? Because you can imagine all kinds of things while you're listening to a really good song or sound, including, for instance, higher order emotions such as hope may result in a wider range of emotional responses to music's expressiveness. Bottom of page 142 into 143. Kania continues, since imagination theorists allow us a wider range of emotional experiences, right? Since imagination theorists allowed us a wider range of emotional experiences, if you're allowed, we can presumably learn more about the emotions from music if such a theory is correct. Thus, the imagination theorist can make a greater appeal to the value of emotional responses to music than a resemblance theorist. Similarly, perhaps, the realist can claim greater cognitive value for our emotional responses. Maybe, I would say, that is yet to be determined. But Kania goes on to talk about the difference between the imagination theorists and the resemblance theorists. And of course, the problem, if I know the folks in class have already read and studied chapter 5 because there's a quiz today. So for those others listening, if you haven't and don't understand what we're talking about here, then just, you know, bear with us. One might learn by one's empathetic response what the expressive artist has felt. This is a quote from the top of page 143. But again, side note, right? If you can't teach empathy, then one can't learn by one's empathetic response what the expressive artist has felt, right? Because more likely, this may be a source of simple pleasure, but more likely it connects to our deeply rooted sense of ourselves as social beings. Now, there's a lot in Gaia here that we could talk about, but we're going to stick with Kania for just today. The more common argument in the cognitive value of emotional responses to music arguments, the more common argument is that our emotional responses help us to perceive and understand the expressive content of the music. Again, can you distinguish between understanding on a cognitive level and not being affected, especially when it has to do with the expressiveness of music? There, our entire human history is about this, which Gioia really goes into in great depth, that you cannot actually understand cognitively without being affected if it's music, because somehow sound affects our brains and our bodies at the same time. And in fact, there is a whole history here, and there is science that now and a long time ago, but recorded in different ways, right? But there's a whole history here that drumming, right? Drumming actually affects the brain. Kind of like a heartbeat, right? Drumming affects the brain quicker than other sounds. And you can read about that or hear about that, listen to the audiobook in Gioia. That's why I have, you know, the audiobook as part of our class, because I think listening to Gioia adds another dimension to the wonderful insights in that work. But if it affects the brain differently than other sounds and quicker, then you cannot separate. The cognitivists have a problem, right? This is just my notes here, because you cannot separate then the actual affect and cognition or understanding. But going back to Kania, he's noting different philosophers like Robinson, Goodman, Ridley, Levinson again, and Davies and Budd. And you don't have to know all those, and we don't have time to know all those right here. But in general, the idea debate here is that it's about that also our emotional responses alert us not only to expressive, but also to structural features in the music itself. Kania writes at the bottom of 143, most philosophers also allow that there can be a therapeutic benefits to emotional responses to music. This is Aristotle's catharsis, but in general, it's not just Aristotle. It doesn't go back to just Aristotle. This Gioia shows us in music, a subversive history, goes back to all of humankind and the species of being human, that there are therapeutic benefits to emotional responses to sound. Now here, we're talking about philosophy, aesthetics, and music, but there are therapeutic benefits to the emotional responses to sound. And that's why, again, side note, therapists have to have certain voices, which I'm trying to do right now, right? I'm putting on my therapist voice hat, even though I am not a therapist. Currently, I'm a professor. I used to be a therapist, and I'm going back into that world and into that profession. So this is more than an empirical question. It's not just about your five senses. As Spinoza understood, affect combines the power of the imagination, which has its own logic, with the power of rationality, which has its own structural logic and structure, with the power of the body's actions and motion and ratios of motion and rest. Rest here is a good thing for Spinoza, but motion is active. Rest can also be active in a Spinozist sense, but basically the gist is that as the power of your rational imaginings, let's just say for now, increase, so too does your body's motion. But the question becomes, how does that get expressed? How does that get felt? Because it can be active and passive in both directions for both of those things. And what is the general overall affect here? And how can you prove what that general overall affect is in the listener, such as you right now? So this also has to do with, and Kaney writes in the middle of page 144, the degree to which such responses are acceptable may turn on broader issues. For instance, the comparative value of knowledge and happiness. So this is an interesting topic of the acceptability of responses, right? What do we have as acceptable responses in society? So listening to the flute player here, definitely in the Greek sense, check your hair, check your nails, right? You know the song, right? This is the brilliance of the power of a flute player and its affect on society. And the Greeks had such problems with the flute players. Ironically, Plato asked for a flute player in his dying moments, apparently. But the strings were considered divine, right? The sound of strings. And I have to admit, I do love the cello, but it's my favorite sound of an instrument if I had to pick one, although I love them all. This has nothing to do with the divine necessarily, although that is an interesting discussion that is beyond belief here, could be a part of that course and will be this semester at Roger Williams. But it's not just about the strings. The strings and the harp have other thing to do with the divine and the gods. And there's a whole history here that Gioia is brilliant about referencing. But here we go, right? The drums and the flute versus the strings and the harp. And the history of that here. So what are considered acceptable responses? And who monitors those? And who gets to say what those are? Especially when they're being like forcefully put on to others, right? Can you forcefully put on to others what you think their response should be, or what you think their preference should be, or what you think their behavior should even be? I mean, how do we do that? Who gets to say? And is it really about the eloquence of a theory if the theory has missed something? If the theory is wrong? If the theory is incomplete, which most theories are, by the way? You can't really talk about simplicity here if the theories are incomplete. And as many scientists and philosophers have understood, even most scientific theories, if not all scientific theories, start out anecdotally. And so we have a lot to talk about here yet. At the least, jumping to page 145, right? At the least, and there's a whole logical structure argument in the middle of page 145, which we can pick up on in class and which will be a part of the quiz today, at least in part. But for now, since we're ending this particular portion of the class lecture style for a change, notice the bottom, page 145. Though most philosophers accept this reasoning about if those benefits require negative emotional responses to music, then perhaps they outweigh the emotional cost. We'll see. Though most philosophers accept this reasoning, some argue that it cannot fully explain our seeking out music that we know will make us sad. For one thing, the solution, like the Radiohead reference, right? Radiohead, ha! Ah. there we go. For one thing, the solution makes the value of our negative emotional responses purely instrumental. When some believe that such experiences have at least inherent value. And a different kind of response to this paradox, the one in the middle of page 145, and everything we've been talking about here today, is to resist the characterization of the affective responses to music or aesthetics in question as negative in the way that makes unproblematic with respect to music. Depending on how one recasts the claims, this might amount to a rejection of the above arguments. And David Hume is interestingly referenced here. Although David Hume's philosophy is brilliant and amazing, it also has a lot of problems from a race theory perspective, and maybe even from an aesthetics of music perspective. But David Hume argues that in our appreciation of great tragedies, ordinarily negative emotions such as pity and fear are subsumed and transformed in our experience of the artistic presentation of the objects of those emotions into pleasurable, non-negative experiences. Many philosophers have found the positive process of transformation more puzzling than the original paradox. The differences between tragedy and instrumental music also raise the question of the extent to which Hume's theory applies to the latter. Caney continues on 146. Philosophers have more recently argued that it is a mistake to characterize the sadness and so on that we feel in response to expressive art as negative. Right? Why not? Realists jump down the page. Realists such as Bear Scout maintain that our emotional responses to fictions are fully fledged. Like pen pals in the ether. Maybe, maybe not. Like pen pals in the virtual, because this is kind of a virtual recording, isn't it? Is it wholly virtual, though? Assuming that the same applies to our emotional responses to music, we could adapt Gout's account of negative emotional responses to fiction to our puzzle. Gout argues that it is not the nature of the object of one's emotion, but rather one's evaluation of that object that makes it appropriate to label the emotion negative. So again, here versus evaluation and preference, objectivity, subjectivity. Though such negative evaluations typically lead us to avoid their targets and are thus typically unpleasant, they don't necessarily do so. As the rational pursuit of roller coaster rides, mountain climbing, and demolition derbies illustrates for fear. In such cases, among which some musical experiences may number, we may enjoy the phenomenological, so that's the body, that's affect, phenomenology, we may enjoy the phenomenological components of such emotional responses. So in other words, you can have a cognitive component. Let's say, for example, in the evaluative cognitivism of a mountain climbing example. I don't have fear of mountain climbing, but there is an interesting fear of heights component here. Folks who have fear of heights have problems getting down the mountain. They don't have problems necessarily getting up the mountain. Some people who have fear of heights, I can think of one particular friend of mine who has a fear of heights. And so I accidentally drove over a bridge once and I had forgotten that he had a fear of heights. And then I felt really bad about that. So that kind of fear of heights has to do with both climbing up the mountain and down the mountain. Interesting, right? Side note. But for me, for example, I have no problem going up the mountain or even beyond on the mountain, but coming down the mountain, that is a sort of interesting fear of heights, isn't it? And it also relates to my bisexuality, by the way, but that's for another day, which we've talked about in class openly here. But what about roller coaster rides? What about demolition derbies? These are the examples given in Cania. Also, in such cases, again, Cania says, among which some musical experiences may number, we may enjoy the phenomenological components of such emotional responses. So again, Compare the decision, he says, at the bottom of page 146 about our approaches to music. Compare the decisions to raising a child. The reasons for doing so are doubtless complex and vary from person to person. So no generalized theories, psychoanalytic or otherwise, here are going to work. Sorry. But surely, Kania says, many people reasonably choose to raise children because they believe it is valuable, worthwhile activity in and of itself, regardless of the paradox, regardless of the complexity, right? If someone points out to such a person that giving the demands of parenting, financial, emotional, and otherwise, they would be happier overall if they did not raise a child, the prospective parent may well respond that that's irrelevant. It is crucial to this analogy. So this is argument by analogy, top of page 147. It is crucial to this analogy that raising a child is being compared to the appreciation not of a single piece of music or a single aesthetic work of art, but rather of music in general or some particular musical tradition or any tradition. One might then object that the cases are not suitably analogous, since when it comes to parenting, one must take the pleasant experiences along with the unpleasant, while when it comes to appreciating music or a work of art, one can easily pick and choose which pieces to appreciate. So free will comes in here, and preference. Free will and preference. Yay! Davies, another philosopher we talked about, right, may respond that appreciating a musical tradition, or any tradition, one might ask, requires appreciating the full range of pieces written in that tradition. What requires appreciating the full range of pieces written in that tradition, such as appreciating both analytic continental philosophy methods, appreciating analytic and continental philosophy texts, appreciating analytic cognitive, because analytic is cognitivism, right? But analytic, continental, pragmatic, existential, some may say supernatural or supernormal or metaphysical theories, appreciating the full range of pieces. Kania says, but this seems to return us to a cost-benefit reasoning problem. So instrumental value problem again. Cost-benefit reasoning. Cost-benefit reasoning. Logic problem, after all. In order to appreciate a musical tradition, or any tradition, maybe, Kania says we must take the good emotional responses with the bad. And it's a paradox. End of story. Right? So this is why next is on resistance. This is why it's on resistance, right? Resistance to the affective value of music. What's valuable in expressive music? 148. What's valuable in expressive music is not the expressiveness itself, but how the expressiveness is realized in the music. Maybe. So that's a subjective-objective distinction there. And subjective-objective problem in the distinction. So the value of formal music and basic musical features we can pick up with later. But, you know, just to end here, Kania writes, since the importance of our emotional experience is independent of music for philosophers of aesthetics, right? Cognitively, affectively, maybe even phenomenologically, the affective value of music seems in danger of being more extrinsic or instrumental than we might have hoped. And then he talks about the beauty of chess and chess strategies, the beauty of mathematics, this is the bottom of page 149, the difference between the musical form of melodies, harmonies, rhythms, and forms of instrumental music when there are performers, but you don't hear any voice, right? The difference between instrumental versus voice, and the history of that is amazing in Gaia, by the way. And the benefit is that, Kania writes at the top of 149, purely musical features would seem to be the best place to look for an intrinsically valuable musical experience. But again, there's a problem from a race theory perspective with that concept of purity. And for the whole history of human beings, which you'll learn about in Gaia, there's a problem with that whole concept of purity. The related drawback of this is that it is unclear why we should find such musical features or aesthetic features valuable at all. Unlike music's affective qualities, which we do find value in. You have your favorite sounds. You have your favorite music. We have our favorite songs. And that's our right to have them because we like the feeling. We like the sound. We like, you know, in my case, I love all music, almost all music. You know, I have my favorites in every genre because sound is so important to my brain and to my body. And I think also to my spirituality. So there's a lot to think about here yet is the point. You know, why do you value the experience of such things? Kanier says. What is it the form? Is it the content? Is it just your phenomenological affect? Is it your just your free will and preference, right? Again, valuation versus preference problem. If Kanier writes at the bottom of 149, if we value the experience of such things for their own sake, intrinsic value here, also a little inherent value, don't you think? If we value the experience of such things for their own sake, according to Kivi now, why wouldn't we expect the value to the experience to value the experience of formal complexity in music? Why wouldn't we expect to value the experience of formal complexity in a human being? I would say, why wouldn't we expect to value the paradox and complexity of the experience of the formal complexity of aesthetics in general, or the formal complexity of, you know, philosophy? You know, there's no one right answer. And that's what makes it so interesting. Okay, so I'll end here. This is Kania's last few pages, which we'll pick up with later. And this is the end of the chapter, but I'll just say a last few notes because I said would be about 45 minutes to an hour. And you'll be hearing it soon. But what is the sense of hearing that we're talking about here, right? What is it that by far the most amenable is that which we hear that's pleasing? Are we intrigued, he asks, with the formal structure of it all, the logic, or the sound, or the feeling? And this is the history of philosophy's problem, right? Is it the temporality? Music is temporal, after all. And oddly enough, Kania says, unlike architecture, again, here's a moment where he's wrong, and he does have a lot of moments where he's wrong. You know, architecture can be proven to be temporal and be in a temporal category, believe it or not. But music is temporal and typically features, this is Kania, 150, and typically features, middle of the page, a number of distinct musical lines pleasing in themselves and in combination. Again, this may not make music unique, since temporal formal complexity arises from the interplay of various individual components in abstract dance or film, for example. Quote, again, a basic feature of musical form that may be unique to music alone among the non-representational arts is the quasi-syntactic nature of functional harmony, or functional harmonies. How the functions of scale, degrees, and chords, and the pleasing harmonies we seem to like in every generation, that's why they just repeat the same chords in all kinds of music, but just do it in unique ways, creatively, right? Keys that give musical forms a kind of systematic diamondism and purposiveness that can generate expectation and satisfaction, tension and release, in a particularly compelling manner. End quote. This might then be about, Kania says, and referencing here again the philosopher of aesthetics, Budd, that music's non-representational nature. So it doesn't represent something else. It's in and of itself something, intrinsically maybe, or inherently. That music's non-representational nature does not prevent its being about music. Interesting, right? But about the transitions between the rests and the pauses and, you know, maybe the combination of the ratios of motion and rest. some might say, like Spinoza. How about imitation of these? Is it imitating beauty? Is this musical form imitating beauty? What an imitation that is a representation, if it is, or is it just the feeling of beauty, or the affect of beauty, or the understanding of beauty, or all of it at the same time? Isn't it, some philosophers would say, all of it at the same time? And so I just got a heads up warning on Anchor that the maximum recording length for segments is 60 minutes. Keep an eye on the clock. That was perfect timing. Thank you, Anchor. Lastly, middle of page 151, the formal values of a piece here structurally, as with any formally rewarding piece of sound or music, are for the most part located not in the coarsest template that might be applied to that piece, but rather in the details of its particular structure that this form makes possible and its similarities to the differences from other pieces exhibiting that same basic form, end quote, right? That makes some sense. Lastly, top of page 152, Alan Goldman argues that music's purely musical content and form, even together with its affective value, cannot explain the distinctive value of music that leads some music lovers to favor it over other arts, since all arts can be appreciated for their basic and formal features. Some painters are better than others. Some filmmakers are better than others. Some dancers are better than others. And Beyoncé is definitely a better singer than you or I. Especially than me, even though I've done coffee houses, you know, and sang my whole life, you know, right? Get the point, right? That's not a subjective evaluation. That's an objective point. Goldman locates music's distinctive value in the fact that it presents us with a sound world separated from our practical lives, but in which we can use our cognitive, affective, and perceptual capacities to their fullest, interacting with something possessing pleasure, formal features, or pleasing, right, formal features, in which all tension, unlike in the real world, is perfectly resolved, end quote. Yes and no, right? There are many challenges to this view, Caney writes. That of experiencing the satisfying resolution, for example, of emotional or other tensions. How do those work? Sometimes it's just, you know, dogs don't wear pants. It's a great film. You should see it. And, you know, at the top of page 153, but if a central value of music is due to its detachment from the everyday, which is really problematic for phenomenologists, right? You cannot detach yourself from the everyday. But for now, let's just end here and say, but if a central value of music is due to its detachment from the everyday world reflected in representational arts such as literature, for example, it is difficult to see how that value could contribute to the value of, say, song, the lyrics of which typically reintroduce the everyday world, which we did with Bob Dylan's example and the song Hurricane in this class during Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday celebration and what we're all going through after the insurrection attempt on the Capitol, with the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. So you will reference that class and be able to make connections here. Future philosophers, Kania writes, of music will have to grapple more directly with both music's non-artistic value and values, as well as the artistic value of works such as songs, films, and dances that combine music with other media.